Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This is Matt Lewis. I play Ron in Cobra Kai and I'm with Chris Gordon on Hellblazer Biz.
Everyone, I have the pleasure and the honor of the company of Matt Lewis today, who among many roles is Ron on Cobra Kai. So welcome, Matt. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to finally meet you. As I say, I've been getting into the show myself recently, and it all started with Susan, who then pointed me to your direction and flooded the gates open with all the Facebook groups that I've been invited to join, which is fantastic. Oh, yeah. The fandom is amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah, it's I've never been a part of anything like this, that the fan base is so supportive and into the show. It's really cool.
It is. It is absolutely fantastic. And like I said, I've already said to you now, you're rocking your Miyagi-Do t-shirt. You've got your Cobra Kai flyer behind you on the wall. It's very, very much. It's just a brilliant show. As I say, I've managed to binge watch because it was on my list for ages, Cobra. I mean, we'll talk about other things, obviously, in a minute, but just while we're on the subject. Because I've been doing what I do on my show, I've got a massive backlog of stuff to watch, which I'm trying to get through. And so Cobra Kai's been there. And then I thought, right, okay, let's get this watched now. Because I was introduced to Susan. And I've just not stopped. It's one of those series where you binge watch, you just can't stop. It's just absolutely fantastic. And the final, I'm not going to ruin it for people who may not have seen it, but I think everyone has who's watching this now. The last episode of that season two, that scene in the school, mind-blowing. It was just, me and my wife were on the edge of our seats just like, just waiting for something to happen.
Yeah. And are you, with that final fight, are you aware of there's like a really famous one-off shot in that fight? Did you catch that when you saw it? You go back and rewatch it, if you go back and rewatch the big thing at the end of episode 10, season 2, there's a shot and it's a single take, and it starts when Tori and what's her name? Sam. Sam. Start fighting, right? And then it's a single take that moves all the way down the hallway, and it lasts almost a minute, I think. And it ends when Stingray comes out of the office and jumps in. But I've heard in other interviews, the big three have talked about that shot a lot. Mm-hmm. And they said that, and it's fascinating when you go back and rewatch it, knowing all this stuff, they said that they had stunt people that were swapping in and out for actors. And I think there was even a time where the stunt woman that covers for Sam also covers for Tori. So she had to jump out of the shot, change costumes, jump back in as another character. And meanwhile, the actors are swapping in and out of that shot too. It's crazy.
Wow.
So if you go back and check that out, it's really cool knowing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, considering how fast that scene was and that just blows my mind. Just shows some very talented people there, both in the actual actors, the stunt people, and the cinematographer and the cameramen, to actually manage to capture everything. Everyone come together, I think that's what makes Cobra Kai really good. Anyway, it's just the fact that it everything gels together so well. They've brought perfect people in for every part of the cast, like yourself and Susan. Obviously, you've got Ralph and William back as well in the main roles, Martin and stuff as well, but everybody, all you guys, all gel together. I mean, your role as well as Ron is brilliant, because I see that coming in, and you're on the board, and you're the sense of reason. Well, I say reason, because to be honest, in season one, I've got to admit, I thought that Danny, the character, was a complete jerk, and I was, which is what it's supposed to be, I think, because you see the whole role of her is a that's what's so exciting, because it wasn't just. Sorry, I'm rambling now. Sorry, Matt. I was just going to say.
No, you're right.
Yeah, this is obviously where you see, because you see that whole season one of, if you think it's a sequel, it's a show built on it 35 years later. But what the clever thing is how they've reversed the roles of the two characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you really do. I mean, even at the end of season two, to be fair, I am still Team Johnny. Because, you know, yeah, he's made some bad, you know, but you start rooting for it because you can see the background, you can see what he's trying to do,
yeah,
where he's come from. And then also Danny's made it big and famous. He's dead, he's really rich. And it's just, it's amazing having that entire, like, mirror flip, isn't it? A 180 flip on the lifestyles. It's fantastic. And I think
that's one of my favorite things about the show is that, you know, it is a continuation of the Karate Kid saga, but it's also its own thing. And it's this, just this perfect combination of drama and comedy, but it also just has 100% of the heart that the Karate Kid movies have always had. And so it's just sort of a successful rehashing of, you know, some great movies, but it's, in no way, shape or form does it ever feel like, you know, they've just dragged this thing back out to make some money, which is, you know, quite often what happens. There's a thing in the business called, I mean, for lack of a better term, it's just name recognition, right? Mm-hmm. So, which is one of the main reasons why so many things get rebooted. And it happens on Broadway a lot too. They'll say, well, yeah, we can take this famous iconic movie, just make it a musical and you know, yeah, we can put it on Broadway. It doesn't necessarily even have to be good. Mm-hmm. It's still going to make a certain amount of money just because people will go, oh, well, I love the Footloose movie, I might go see the musical, you know, just because it's got that instant name recognition. But this Cobra Kai is not guilty of that in any way, shape or form. And I think I would be a super fan of the show, even if I didn't have anything to do with it. I can guarantee that. And I remember auditioning for, I think, at least three other roles before I booked Ron. Mm-hmm. And when I'm based in Atlanta, so in the Southeast, now everyone's self-taping auditions, but in the Southeast for the longest time, almost all of our auditions were self-tapes. Whereas if you go to an audition in LA or New York, you usually have an appointment and you go in person.
Yeah.
But here, since they're casting out of a whole region, it's just easier to tape. And so they never, when we get an audition, they never send us the whole script, but we'll get a couple of pages for just our little scene. Mm-hmm. And so everything that I got to read, I mean, I remember getting that first audition for Cobra Kai and I was like, pardon my French, but like, holy shit, like what is this? This is what? Mm-hmm. And I was just so excited because I grew up a huge Karate Kid fan. And everything that I got to read was, like I said before, just this perfect balance of comedy, but it still was, you know, honoring the original material. And so I just kept thinking, I mean, they shoot Stranger Things here, they shoot Avengers movies here, they shoot The Walking Dead here. And I just kept thinking, like, I don't care. Like, I want Cobra Kai. Like, this is what, shouting this into the universe, this is what I want. Not that I wouldn't love to be in an Avengers movies too, but you know what I mean. It's been just such a blast and such a privilege to be able to be, you know, part of that world.
No, fantastic. It's great. And you're right. I think his, you know, like you say, I knew you were a fan of Karate Kid anyway. But it's such a legacy. It's like there's certain things in certain films which have lasted the tales of time. Obviously, you've got Jaws, you've got Star Wars, you've got Indiana, and you've got the Karate Kid. And, you know, I mean, even before Cobra Kai was around, we were painting fences in my back garden and things like that. And, you know, and it was, and it was always like, you know, I was doing this and taking the mic and doing the, you know, waxing the car. I was teaching my son to do the wax on and wax off.
Exactly.
And he's like, what are you doing, Dad?
Yeah. And if you're working on something in the yard, you know, you always want to try and hit the nail in with one tap, you know, always. Yeah, sure.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think I won 1985, wasn't it? Or was it 83? So I was about 8 or 10 when it came out. So yeah, totally influenced my life.
Oh, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out in 84. And I remember because my dad had gotten a new job. He was a professor. Mm-hmm. And he had just finished his PhD in theater and he had gotten his first teaching job. And so that's at the beginning of that summer, our family moved for the first time to a different state.
Right.
And I was a new kid, and right in our vicinity of the neighborhood. So I was going into fourth grade. Mm-hmm. And so I could cruise around on my bike a little bit, but you know, not all over town. And right. There weren't a lot of kids in our area that mm-hmm. I saw. And so that summer, we moved at the beginning of the summer, and I didn't make any friends until school started at the end of the summer. So that summer was like pretty, pretty long and lonely. But Karate Kid came out, and I went and saw it a couple of times. And of course, this is, you know, way before videotapes and, you know, all that stuff. But I mean, you know, watching Daniel navigate being a new kid while I was being a new kid at the same time, just really helped me get through that summer. Mm-hmm. And I remember I had the soundtrack on vinyl, and I dubbed it onto a cassette tape. And so I just put that thing in my Walkman and just rode my bike around the neighborhood for the whole summer and wore that thing out. And I still have that album on vinyl, and actually got, Ralph to sign it for me. The last time I was working, which was really cool. Yeah.
That's impressive. That's a fantastic little tale.
Yeah, no, it was
kept
great.
It with you all your life, and then yeah, finally get him to sign. No, that's really good.
Well, yeah, and it, you know, to your point where you're talking about Star Wars, I mean, you know, in my line of work, especially with the roles that I've been booking now, mm-hmm. I'm often in for like a few episodes as sort of a supporting character, but because of that, like, you know, I meet famous people. Like, it just, you get to work with them, they're around, it happens. And it's one of the really cool perks of the job. But if I booked something and I was like, oh wow, I get to do, like, get to spend a day with Billy Zabka and Ralph Macchio, like, that would be cool. But I got to spend a day with Johnny and Daniel and yeah. like speak to them in character. I mean, it was just astounding. It was amazing.
Definitely. That's what I mean. Yeah. Cause you're right. Cause you, like you say, you can be around them when you're doing these various parts on things, but your scenes are specifically with those two characters. So yeah, I can just imagine the excitement, as I say, when you've grown up with it all your life, and then you're there in the room with them, with the two people who've, like, you know, forged that battle long ago, sadly too long, getting longer and longer, isn't it? Cause it's when you go on those little, things where you have to put your date in on the internet and you have to start. That's what's depressing me.
Right?
You have to keep scrolling.
Keep scrolling, yeah.
Yeah, when they first came out, it was just quick. It was just like that. Now it's like...
Yeah.
It's good. So, I mean, obviously you are an established actor as well, Matt, and you've had many, been on many things as well, not just in film. I was going to say, what drives you in what are your motivations in this cutthroat industry that you're in? Because it is, I mean, you know, for every time we see a decent role where you've got one on screen like that I know there's a lot of work on in the background to actually manage to get that role, many people who go for it as well. So what motivates you? What drives you?
Well, to a certain extent, being an actor is kind of the family business for me. My dad was an actor. Mm-hmm. He's a jack of all trades. I mean, he's done it all. He's a playwright, he's a director, he's a professor, he's an actor. And he ran a small theater program at a community college mm-hmm. in North Carolina for almost 30 years. And so when I was, I think maybe 11, he was just starting out with it. It had been around for maybe a year or two. And he was developing it. He ended up, what turned out to be just him teaching an intro to theater class and having a class put on a play, because it was small and they could. Over the next few years, he had built a 2 years associate's degree program so people could get a 2 year degree under him and then transfer on somewhere else and finish out with a bachelor's or a BFA in theater. And so while he was running that program, he was a one-man band. He did everything. He taught all the classes, he directed the plays, he trained all the technicians, he built the set, he lit the set, painted it, taught everybody how to do everything, ran the box office, made the program, everything. And so when I was coming up in middle school, there were a couple of times where the program was so small that he couldn't fill out the cast of a play just with students. And so the first time I ever did a play, it was a really classic American comedy called The Foreigner. Mm-hmm. And he needed to cast the role of Ellard, and he didn't have anybody do it. And he was already in it. Yeah. There was nobody else to do it. He was like, "Hey, I kind of need you to be in this play this summer." And I said no, because that sounded horrifying. And then also, like, I didn't want to go to work with my dad all summer. I wanted to, like, skateboard with my friends and stuff. Mm-hmm. But he finally talked me into it. And he actually, it's a funny story, because he told me a lie to trick me into being into the play, because I kept saying no. And then finally he came back and said, "Well, look," and this was total BS, but he said, "Look, I already put your name in the program, and they printed off thousands of programs. And if you don't do this play, then I will have wasted all that money and I might get fired. So you kind of have to do it." And I was like, "Ah, fine, whatever." And then, of course, you know, once I started doing it, mm-hmm. it was a blast, and I got hooked. And so I went on to major in theater myself, and I've just been doing it ever since. They always say that, because, you know, to your point, that acting is such a cutthroat business and such a difficult world to navigate in so many different ways, whether it's film and television or theater or whatever, if you can find something else to do that will bring you just as much joy, then do that instead, because it's going to be easier and it will break your heart less. And, you know, so do that. And I never found that thing. In my 20s, I tried to not be an actor for a while, and and it didn't work. So here I am.
Fair enough. I actually went down, because I was acting. I loved acting when I was younger. Yeah. I did a lot of theatre, school musicals. I was in the musicals, was Drake the Butler and Annie that we did. Nice. But yeah, I was steered down that path of be a bit more, you know, that like you just said, it goes back in, especially back then, it was like, you want to be having a sensible career. You want one that, you know, because actors are notoriously unemployed. That's all I got told. And I got steered by people away from drama and away from acting, which is what I truly loved. And it's the past few years doing this show, I've actually ended up being in a film as well.
Oh, cool.
So I'm starting it back up again, because it's a passion that's never, it's a vocation. I think acting is rather, it's not, you know, I mean, I was saying it's a job before as well, but it's not, it's a vocation. It's a way of life is when you're in your acting. And like you say, with yourself, with your dad, and the esteemed skills and talent that he has from what you're rolling off there, that is, it's no easy feat to do any of those, let alone do all of them together. It's
right.
Just absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, it's a passion that it never goes away. And I think if you haven't got your heart in it, and you haven't, you know, then that's where you see people fall by the wayside, is if they haven't got that passion to push on, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the issue, like you say, the heartache to go through.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've done 20 years in IT. I can't say it's a job that I love. Actually, yes, according to my boss, who might be watching, I do love my job.
There you go. Great. The best.
But, you know, but obviously for something that, you know, you want to live, and that's why this show started up, is because I wanted to get involved again in at least some to have that passion going. So,
well, and I think being based in Atlanta is a really great place to be right now. I mean, of course, with COVID, you know, the industry is sort of on pause, but the state of Georgia provides these really great tax incentives to productions to come shoot here. The cost of living is just generally cheaper than it is in LA or in New York.
Yeah.
But the other thing that we have going for us is studio space, because all the studio space in New York, LA, Toronto, Chicago, London, it's full. Like, you just can't find sound stages. They're all taken up. And if you can find them, you've got to book them out way in advance, and they're really expensive. Here, there's warehouses galore. So if you drive out, Atlanta is intersected by two interstates. There's 75, 85 that goes north and south, and then Interstate 20 goes east and west through Atlanta. If you go out I-20 for like 10 minutes in either direction, you're in these like industrial areas. They're just filled with warehouses. And so these production companies come in just like Cobra Kai. production companies come in and rent those spaces out and turn them into sound stages. It's cheaper to shoot. It's cheaper to cast, to take, you know, all of your principal talent, the director, the producers, all that stuff, your main crew members. It's cheaper to take all of those folks from LA, put them up here in Atlanta for 6 months or 8 months or whatever to shoot a movie than it is just to shoot at home in LA. So because of that, so because of that, there's a ton of film and television work here currently, and there's commercials. But then also the theater scene's really great too. So a lot of us are able to work in both mediums. And so I think that that sort of softens the blow a little bit in terms of work, because I could audition for Stranger Things and not get it, but that's okay, because I've got this play coming up in 6 months that I'm going to work on. Or if I audition for this play and I didn't get it, well, that's all right, because, you know, season two of Raising Dion is coming back, and hopefully I'll be back for that. So, you know, you just, you can keep more plates spinning that way. There's more opportunities.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I've heard that about Atlanta before. I've had several focal point because of that. Exactly, as you just explained it. So, I mean, you know, there's quite a few people who've based themselves now. They've moved down to Atlanta because they'll find themselves, they're going to get more chance of getting a role in a decent series or anything like that, or any kind of work going is going to be in Atlanta rather than in LA. Just to say, simply because of the costs, it's phenomenal, to be honest. I mean, I know that from London, when I lived in London, the costs of a place to live there, let alone a place to rent a huge warehouse space, it was ridiculous. There are a lot of independent actors as well. They just they move out to the country for it.
Yeah. And then speaking to, you know, as I continue to work here in Atlanta, when I'm speaking to actors that are based in LA, like I remember I had this exact same conversation with Sholo and all of the Karate Kid or all the Cobra Kai kids.
Yeah.
That main cast, we were just sort of sitting in the green room, Mary, and you know, we were talking about them living in LA versus working here. And they said that, and I've heard this from a lot of actors. I had the same conversation with Natalia Dyer a couple of years ago, where, you know, she's based in LA, but she spends so much time out here that she's never home. And so it's almost like she didn't, as far as I know, she hasn't like purchased a house here or anything, but I remember talking to her. We were shooting a movie a couple of years ago called Yes, God, Yes, which is actually going to come out next week on video on demand on iTunes and all that stuff. And I play her dad. But I was talking to her about that, and she was like, yeah, I'm here for 3 or 4 months or whatever it was shooting this. Then I get to go home for a couple of weeks. Then I'm back for Stranger Things. And, you know, that takes, you know, 6 months or whatever, 8 months. And then she's home for a little while. And then she was back here shooting another movie. The Cobra Kai kids were telling me the same thing. They're just sort of always out here because there's so much stuff out here shooting right now.
Wow. it's just crazy. And I think that's the other part of an actor's job is when you're filming away, because you are away for such a long time, and then you're only home. It's a very, very tough life. Yeah. So, I mean, it's great. Atlanta seems to be fair. I mean, I've spoke to loads. I've got Erin Burns as well. She's lovely. There's quite loads of people who are based in Atlanta now and have little schools going. And I was going to say, part of you being, I mean, it's not just Cobra Kai. Like you said, you've got lots of big franchises that you've been a part of, you know, Sleepy Hollow, Dynasty, you know, one of the biggest ones. I think in Sleepy Hollow, you're a mutual friend of ours, Dustin Lewis as well, I think.
That's right. I was in an episode. I got killed by a smoke monster in the cold open. So I got slaughtered before the opening credits. But it was a fun day. And I remember, because we were in a band, and so I was there, I think, for 3 days actually, because we had to get together as the band and learn the song, and then we had to record it. And then we shot the scene, and then they brought us back for another day, but none of us understood why, because we had already seemingly shot our footage.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get killed in this garage. So they bring us back for this extra day, and we get paid by the day. So it's like, bring me back. I don't care. So we show up and we get the sides. And as it turns out, all it is that since we've been murdered, the detective that's trying to solve the crime or whatever shows up to the crime scene, mm-hmm. and she's got this little scene to shoot. But we're all on the floor under sheets. Like, we're not in the shots. Yeah. They took some crime scene photos, and so those showed up. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a purpose for us being there, but
yeah.
I just remember lying on this cold garage floor under a sheet for like 20 minutes going like, man, this is easy money. Like, I'm very, very glad to be back for this.
Yeah, sounds fair enough. The film I actually was in, I ended up being on a cold, hard concrete floor as well, with my hands tied behind my back. And I had to, because that was a long 12-hour day, because they are long days, sure. for like two-minute scene.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And at the end, I was having to lie with my hands tied behind my back, because, long story short, it was a nasty character, which I didn't realise until I got there, because they only gave me the part of the script where I was actually had my lines to speak. When I got there, they turned around and they were like, "Are you sure you're okay with playing that kind of a character?" And I was like, "What? What kind of character is he?" I'm an office manager, aren't I? And they went, "No," because he was actually a pedophile. And I was like,
part of "Oh, gotcha."
Didn't have to do anything like that, thankfully, or any. It was just office speech, but it was implied. It was part of the implied part of it,
right?
But even so, I was like, really? Okay. Might have told me that before I came.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, because there are, you know, like the character that I play on Raising Dion is not a good man. He's he's not really aware of it, but he's super racist.
Yeah.
And there are times where I've had auditions for things, and I've looked at the material that I was given. Maybe it was the whole script, maybe it wasn't, but there have been several times where I've just gone back to my agent and said, you know what, I don't even want to audition for this. It just seems like whatever, you know, if this person is a racist or a rapist or a pedophile or whatever, sometimes when the writing's not good, it just seems like that person is maybe being celebrated or at least amplified, but they're just sort of there for their own sake, as opposed to like the character that I play in Raising Dion.
Yeah.
He's a real bastard, but my character's behavior generates the opportunity for this great scene with Dion and his mom, African-American mom and an African-American boy. They get to have this, they have the talk about what it's like to be Black in America. And, and Dion's a really little kid. And so, you know, for me, you know, not being a person of color, I'm aware of those situations. And I can talk to my kids about stuff like that from our perspective, but it's nowhere near the same thing as being able to be a fly on the wall and watch that conversation happen behind closed doors in a Black family. So the fact that like my character helped, you know, sort of propel that part of the story, I didn't mind being a bad guy for that. But you know, sometimes I don't want to be that person.
No, exactly. I get what you mean. I mean, the reason I was on the floor at the end was because he was getting his comeuppance and they're pouring acid over the over the bits down below. I'll just have it. I'll politely put it down there.
Wow.
So yeah, I had to lie, but it was 2 hours while they got while they were getting the film and the shot right. So I was like handcuffed on my back on a concrete floor.
Oh wow.
I'm getting paid $20 for the day for this. Cause it was, I just did it cause I wanted to experience.
Yeah,
I was just like, is this really worth it? Yes, it is. I love it. watching, you know, I was busy watching the cameraman and the cinematographer setting the scenes and stuff. Cause it was fantastic.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Being on set is just super exciting. It never, never gets old.
No, he's saying there's so many people buzzing around and doing their own little different things, and they're doing it so expertly. It's great to see and just see how it all comes together. And again, when that does happen in a good way, that's when it's just show, like you say with Cobra Kai, the way the writers have done it and everyone has come in, it's been brought in with such a respect that the show is just, it is just a hit. And obviously with season 3 going on Netflix now too, so I'm very vocal with my hands tonight. So, going on season 3 on Netflix, that'll be it's going to be, it's going to blow up even better, which would be
fun. I think so too. I mean, I love the show very much. And like I said, mm-hmm. even if I didn't have anything to do with it, it would still be one of my favorite shows ever. But there are a lot of friends that I've talked to, over the years. They, you know, they'll come to me and still like this 3 years later or whatever, be like, mm-hmm. oh man, I still need to watch your show. I'm like, well, okay, then, you know, go ahead. They're like, how do I do that? I'm like, it's on YouTube Premium. They're like, yeah, I'm not going to sign up for another streamer thing. Maybe I'll just wait. So the fact that, you know, it is, I saw Ralph in an interview pretty recently, and he mm-hmm. was asked about that. And he said that Cobra Kai moving from YouTube Premium to Netflix is kind of like moving from off Broadway to Broadway.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty, that's pretty a really great way to put it.
Actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's just, it's this underdog show in so many ways. And so it's going to be really exciting, I think, for, you know, for it to be exposed to a much broader audience. And then also the fact that, you know, hopefully based on the success of season 3, mm-hmm. knock on wood, mm-hmm. that they'll be able to have, you know, multiple seasons, beyond three, so that they can really tell the story that they've, you know, created. And you were just talking about how, about the company of Cobra Kai and, mm-hmm. and how, you know, that it's successful because of the people that are in it.
Yeah.
And I have to say this anytime that I get the chance, that the big three, Josh, Hayden and John and Ralph and Billy and all the Cobra Kai, I mean, everybody involved in that show, the Frank, the costume guy, like the fight choreographers, everybody mm-hmm. is so cool and so sweet. Ralph and Billy, I mean, there are other shows that I've done, where, you know, they're super famous people in them, and they sort of, they'll whisk in from wherever they've been hiding on set mm-hmm. and they'll do their thing. And then they go back to their big fancy trailer, which is somewhere like we can't even see. And you know, there are a lot of actors that are sort of on a, you know, a varying spectrum of that, you know, they're working with you, but at the same time, like I'm in for 2 days. This is their third year on the show mm-hmm. and they're kind, but you know, I'm in for 2 days.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of, you know my place. And sometimes, you know, us day players just know and understand that, you know, these famous people may not really want to hang out with you, even if they're forced to sit right next to you while we're waiting for the next shot. Ralph and Billy are the exact opposite of that. Like those guys are around all the time. They were part of the team. Mm-hmm. And all the kids were really sweet. And then the big three, the producers, like they're so interactive with everyone and so interactive with the fans on social media. Like that's so exceptional and so awesome. I think that's
one of
the things that's going to, help buoy, Cobra Kai into like maximum success. It's just, I mean, they're awesome people.
No, it sounds fantastic. They look like they have so much fun. I was actually going to say, there was one, when you're talking about the actors, obviously some when they come on set, there was one, do you remember Michael Sheard? Played Admiral Ozzel in Empire Strikes Back and played Hitler in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Vaguely
remember, yeah. I did a documentary with him about 15 years ago when I was reenacting. I was a German stormtrooper stood like that in the air. That was all my role was to be. He came and I was told beforehand because I'm really excited because he was Star Wars actor and all that, you know.
Sure.
And exactly what you've just said, that some will come on and people were saying he's a big famous actor. He goes, he won't even know you're there. And it's like, right, okay. And then I was stood in the hotel lobby checking in. I was getting a drink at the bar and I looked next to me and he was there and I was like, you know, starstruck. He turned around, he goes, are you doing this documentary? I was like, yeah. And he goes, let me buy you that drink. And he bought the drink. He drank us dry under the table for 3 nights in a row while we were filming. He stayed with us from like, you know, we filmed all day and then he stayed with us till like 1 or 2 o'clock every morning telling us stories of Star Wars. And I thought, you know.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's
yeah, I got to do a episode of Ozark And the scene was with Jason Bateman.
Yeah.
But you know, of course he's like, he's a producer, and I don't know if he didn't direct that episode, but you know, as an executive producer and one of the, you know, the main creatives in the show, like he's got lots of plates that he has spinning and lots of things to do. So he didn't, you know, he was very kind when he came in and shot with me, but he obviously had many other responsibilities on set. But I hung out with, Peter Mullen and Laura Linney and a couple of the other actors in the show, and they were so sweet. And we were, because we were shooting inside a house, we were being held in like a small guest bedroom off to the side of the living room where we were shooting. It was this big house, and then, you know, the trailers aren't that far away and stuff. Yeah. So Laura Linney could have very easily, while she was waiting for her stuff to be shot, she could have gone back to her fancy trailer somewhere and spent her time there, but she didn't. She squeezed into this guest room with the rest of us, and we all just hung out and talked about movies and books. And it was, you know, I think that's something that I have learned, and something that I will definitely take with me as I move forward. Just to have like really good role models like Ralph and Billy. I remember when we were shooting the board scene in season one, we were on the dinner break.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting down with my three other board members, because we had made fast friends, and that's kind of what you do. Yeah. And we were all eating together. Ralph and Billy were around, all the kids were around and stuff. But John Hurwitz came over and sat with us and introduced himself again, and then went down the table and told each of us how much they had all enjoyed our auditions for the roles that we booked, but then also other auditions that we had had. He remembered all this stuff. Wow. And you know, he spent a part of his dinner break talking to us, whereas most of the time, like, I might know who the producer is, but I'm not going to have a conversation with. There are times where I haven't even met the director. Like, somebody's just shouting at me from another room, or the AD will come over and give me adjustments from the director. So the fact that they're like so hands-on, when we started shooting that day, they all lined up and came down the table and shook our hands and introduced themselves to us. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, hi, I'm Billy Zabka. Like, oh, hi, I'm Billy Zabka. It was nuts. They're all just so cool. It's great.
So I would have been, Johnny!
For sure.
Sweep the leg. Yeah. Excellent. I've had a few questions, or a couple of questions sent in. Emma, I've left this one because it's about theatre, because I normally ask about your theatre as well, because I know you've got an extensive theatre background.
Yeah.
Emma, she goes as Dorothy on Twitter, but her name is Emma. She says, how does it, this isn't a theatre one, actually, that's another one. So, anyway, Emma, would I like to know, how does it feel being part of the legacy? We've just been talking about this, of the Karate Kid legacy. She said, Ron's such a fan favourite, she hopes to see him back in season 3, which obviously we all do. So, yeah, in a summary, we've just spoken about it pretty much half an hour, how cool it is. So.
Sure. No, I mean, it's an incredible honour to be, you know, part of the Karate Kid universe. It's not something that I ever would have imagined or expected. But I'm, you know, just damn proud to be part of it. And, I hope the show is just as successful as it can be. And like I said a couple of times already, like, even if I didn't have anything to do with the show, like, I would still adore it and be just as much of a nerd about it as I am. And just being in it is, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I'll just wake up in the morning and realize that, and it makes me smile and giggle and it makes my day good. It's just so fun. And then also, like, the fans are so cool. Like, I've never, you know, being based here in Atlanta and having had such a, you know, an extensive theater background for decades here. There are other actors that I know that have, you know, become, you know, pretty famous in their own right. Randy Havens plays the science teacher on Stranger Things. I can't think of the guy's name right now, the character's name, but Randy's like a really good dude, and he's like, you know, been around Atlanta for decades. And so watching guys like that, or actors like that, gals too, you know, luck out into something like that, and then see like these, you know, these really interactive sort of like Dragon Con sci-fi fan bases that are so, you know, rabid. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, me stumbling into Cobra Kai, like it's so cool. Like my son came into my office today. He was like, "Dad, what are you doing?" I was like, "Well, somebody asked for my autograph, and so I'm signing these pictures and I'm going to mail it off to him." And he was like, "Wow, you were famous enough that somebody wants your autograph? Like, that's pretty cool." And I was like, "I know, that is pretty cool." Like, so yeah, it's an honor and a privilege, and it's just so great.
Fantastic, fantastic.
One of the highlights of my professional life, for sure.
Excellent, excellent. Excuse me. You've obviously staged there as well. With your stage background that you've got, and obviously coming from that, do you have a preference? I mean, this is a hard question because, and I'll say it's hard, not it's because the two mediums are so different in the performance. They're 180 degrees in the performances that you give for screen or theatre. So I appreciate that. But is there a one that you prefer to do? Do you prefer being in front of the camera or in front of a live audience?
I like working, and I like the creative process. So that being said, like, yeah, they are very, very different. I mean, the very essential fundamentals here and here are the same.
Yeah.
But then everything that you're doing externally, it's insanely different. And then also the work process is insanely different. So I love doing theater because it's hard as hell. And so it's exciting and there's a rush, as you know. And there's just nothing like, you know, nailing that song or nailing that joke that you've been working on for weeks to get just right. And then, you know, on that perfect night, you crush it. The audience is laughing. It brings you joy. It brings them joy. We're in this, you know, communal human experience all together. Like there's nothing like that, working on camera. But that being said, you know, working on camera, is fun and challenging in its own ways. It's liberating because you don't have to get it right just once. You can do it 50 different times or however many chances you get, and then they can cut it together and, you know, figure it out. For just in a purely selfish way, like the recognition is mm-hmm. more for screen time because, you know, it can be seen over and over and over again, over, you know, an infinite amount of time. So that's exciting too. And then also the paychecks are a lot better.
Yeah.
I like doing both. I think lately my real joy has sort of gravitated more towards on camera work. Mm-hmm. But I still do a play every other year. I used to do them maybe like 3, 4, 5 times a year.
Yeah.
When that was sort of my primary artistic outlet. But mm-hmm. over the last few years, just because the work's blown up here so much, I don't really have the time that I did because it's such, you know,
it's a very intensive and a very time consuming.
Yeah. It's a big commitment. And then there are some theaters here that are really great about giving us understudies. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody, you know, books a commercial or something and they're going to have to miss a performance or two, there's a few theaters here that will say, "All right, great. We'll put your understudy in. Congratulations. Make that money. We'll see you when you get back. We got you covered." Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other theaters that are the opposite of that. And so, sometimes it's just not fair to sign a contract with them that's going to last, 10 weeks when I can't guarantee I'm going to miss something, but I'm probably going to miss something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when in those initial contract negotiations, like that's always part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm having that conversation, it's like, "Hey, by the way, like I'm recurring on at least 2 TV shows right now and there's other stuff down the pike. So I need an understudy. And if I book something and if I get called into work, like I've got kids, I got to go get that money and be in that thing. And you're going to miss me for a couple of days and then I'll be back. And that's got to be okay." And sometimes the answer is like, "Well, No. So, just have to, you have to get it figured out.
Yeah, no, totally understandable, totally understandable. I know what you mean about the buzz as well, because I say it was only amateur dramatics when I was in school, but even 30 years on, I can remember there was one line as Drake the Butler. I'd been watching The X-Files, and I'd been practicing this line as Mulder had done it on one of the, when he was being taken over by another person, and I just came up and I was like, Daddy Warbucks, it's the FBI. And I said it, and the entire audience just burst out laughing, and they just... Yeah. And they all gave me, I was written in the paper as well, the critic acclaimed the disdain in the voice of the Drake the Butler when he was mentioning the FBI. I was like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. 30
years old, better when you remember that.
Yeah. Nothing better when you have an idea like that. And then it all just sort of comes to fruition.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. And Helen Irvin has actually asked, this following on from the theatre work. Mm-hmm. Obviously, which Broadway or West End show would you love to be in?
Oh man, that is a tough question, and I think it really. There's a musical called Fun Home, that I got to see on Broadway when it was still running. I saw it at Circle in the Square, so they did it in the round.
Yeah.
With the audience surrounding the stage on all sides. And the dad role in that show is a really good role and really great for me. It was done, Fun Home was done here by a local theater a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But with scheduling and stuff, I didn't even audition for it because I just wasn't available. But that would be a great one. And speaking of Fun Home, when I saw Fun Home on Broadway, it was a matinee, so it's supposed to start at 2:30, I think. And so quite often, even on Broadway, like they will hold the house for 5 or 10 minutes while everyone's still getting in, you know, and settling down and stuff. So they held the house for 5 and then it was like 2:40 and then it was like 2:50 and we're all sort of looking around at each other. The show's in the round. So the audience, we can all see each other and everyone, you know, seats are full, like let's go. And we can see like these ushers walking around and people walking talkies and stuff. And finally, the actor that plays the dad, Michael Severus, came out and said, "Hello, everyone. Sorry for the delay. Right around half hour," which is, actors are called half an hour before curtain. That's when they're required to be at the theater. He said, "Right around half hour, the soundboard blew up." Oh. And so the band ran around the city and they got little practice amps and stuff. And so they've sort of, you know, amplified themselves and figured that out. And so they're going to play like that. But we're going to do the show without mics. And so see you in a second. And so they did the show in the round, a musical with a live band with no microphone, which meant that they had to like, you know, sing part of it like this, but then also sort of cheat around like this. So we could over here, like get some voice. And then on top of that, in the premise of the show, there's a woman having memories about her childhood growing up, and there's three versions of Allison in the play. So there's little Allison, middle Allison, which is like college Allison, and the adult Allison is remembering this play and telling us about the past, about her youth. The middle Allison understudy was in. So no soundboard, no mics, swing in for middle Allison. And when they finished, and they did a great job, but it was just so exciting because you could tell that it wasn't just like a regular day at the office for any of them. When they finished the play and after the curtain call, they just piled on each other on the stage and were just hugging and laughing like they had just won the Super Bowl, because they kind of had the theater Super Bowl. So Fun House, there's an answer.
Excellent. Brilliant. I love In the Round. I watched The Crucible with John Joe O'Neill in the round.
Oh, nice.
And that was a very powerful, obviously, you know, it's a powerful play anyway, but it was really good. Very, very good.
Yeah. I'm too old now, but I always wanted to play Bobby in a Company as well.
Fair enough. Excellent. Helen also asks, she's heard you're a teacher. She goes, is this true? Is it drama in the arts? And if so, are you planning on progressing to more hands-on behind the scenes in the future? a producer and director, following your father's footsteps, I guess.
Sure. I've directed some plays. Mm-hmm. I am a professor. I'm an adjunct part-time theater professor at Kennesaw State University, which is here in the Atlanta area. And I've been teaching there since 2012 off and on, and that's kind of, it's my day job.
Yeah.
I got my master's in fine arts, at the University of Alabama, graduated from there in 2012. Mm-hmm. And so I've been able to teach on the university level since then. And so, you know, I do that. And it does bring me joy. I mean, of course, it's also a job, but there are aspects of it that I really like. I like being able to work in my field and talk about, you know, my craft. Mm-hmm. I almost always teach, it's KSU calls it theater in society, but it's like theater appreciation or intro to theater. Mm-hmm. It's a humanities elective, yeah, that students kind of have to take.
Okay.
They've got a few choices, but they like to take the theater because it's a little easier. If you're taking dance or music or art, those classes are harder because you have to memorize a ton of stuff. Like in the art class, the final exam is just like, here's 40 paintings. You have to tell me like who did it, when, where, why. And so it's, yeah. And then in the theater class, we're just making these short plays and that's our final exam.
Yeah.
So, the class, is pretty popular. So it's also cool to be able to turn people onto theater. Mm-hmm. Because it's an art form that could always use more exposure, I guess, for lack of a better term. And there are a lot of people that think that they know what theater is like, or they've already decided that they don't like it.
Yeah.
But their exposure to it has been so limited. I mean, if you saw, like, you know, your girlfriend or boyfriend and some horrible thing in high school and you didn't like that, and then your grandma dragged you to see, you know, Phantom of the Opera or whatever, and you didn't like that, and that's your only two experiences.
Yeah.
Then, you know, of course you don't like it. But if you find, you know, exposing these kids to a broader spectrum of theater so that they learn like, oh my God, like it doesn't really matter who I am and what my sensibilities are. There's theater out there for me. There's a, you know, we live in a big city. So like, mm-hmm, you know, if you like, you know, dark, weird indie stuff, then there's theaters that do that. If you like big, brassy, polished musicals, then there's theaters that do that. And, you know, classics and everything in between. So getting these kids to understand that is pretty cool. And there have been like a few times, more than a few times, but kids that just sort of stumbled into my class because they had to take a humanities elective, mm-hmm, have gone on to become theater majors and then graduated and gone on to, awesome, like actually work in the field. They're kids that I've had in my classes that I now see at auditions for commercials and stuff.
Brilliant.
So that's, yeah, it's like my little names on their resume or something. It's pretty cool.
That must be a really, really good feeling. And you're right. I think I had a really good drama teacher of mine, and it's a real, when you're in, to introduce you to there are, you know, he was very much like you in that respect, that he wanted to introduce people to other aspects of theatre because they've very, very had very little exposure to it. I mean, and I think my GCSE, which, oh God, you haven't got an equivalent, it's when you're 16, we sit GCSEs, we did Jerome K. Jerome's Three Men in a Boat, and we actually, it was the first time it had been made into a play, so no one had ever done it anywhere in the world, and a theatre group were touring the UK and they were in Mold, and my drama teacher had gone to them and asked, could we borrow the script to do it for a GCSE for the exams. He said, yeah, it won't go anywhere else, and they said, yeah, sure. So even before they'd had a chance to perform it as a premiere performance, because I was there, we were doing Three Men in a Boat, wow, by Jerome K. Jerome, and we were sat in the boat. It was a funny play, that one. Brilliant.
Oh, it's amazing.
But that was the inspiration, that's the feeling I got, because that was our teacher who'd inspired us to do that, and I'm sure some of them have gone on as well. Some of our friends have gone on and done other things too, which is when you have that at an early age, I think, you know, I applaud you for that. It's brilliant to have that. That's kind of an inspiration to follow.
So, yeah. Cool.
The last question I've got from before I go on to my signature one, I know we've gone on, mm-hmm, for quite a while, I've rambled away. So this one's actually from someone who I've never really heard of, is Susan Gallagher.
Oh yeah, I know her.
Hey Susan, she's thrown this question in. She was like very excited that you're coming on. So she goes, "Are you attending any comic cons?"
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to. It's you know one of those things. I hope that you know as Cobra Kai's audience explodes, like it probably will. You know, mm-hmm. once it drops on Netflix, that you know maybe. There will be situations where, you know, people will reach out to me or us, Susan, and, you know, the rest of the gang and call us in. The only, so yeah, totally not opposed to that. sounds like a lot of fun. There's another podcast called Cobra Kai Companion.
Yep.
And it's based based out west in the upper Northwest. But Peter, the guy that runs it, we text and stuff, and he was like, "Hey man, I'm coming to Atlanta for Dragon Con." Like he had gone to Vegas and won some money, you know, not a ton, but enough to like cover the trip. And so he was like, he talked to his wife, and he was like, "Hey, I think I want to go to Dragon Con if that's okay." And somehow he convinced her to let him spend this money to take the trip. But the cool thing was that, and of course, there's a ton of local Atlanta talent that's in Cobra Kai, but none of us were asked to be on any panels or anything like that. Mm. Certainly not myself or any of the other committee members. But what Peter did from Cobra Kai Companion is that he set up a meet and greet for fans, like at Dragon Con. It wasn't actually part of the con, but there was a bar right there. Yeah. And he figured it all out. And he and Brianna and a couple other people that are really involved in their network there at Cobra Kai Companion set this thing up. And a bunch of the local actors showed up. But there were all these, because it was Dragon Con, there were all these fans there from all over the world. So I met like, you know, they didn't come specifically just to meet me. They were there for Dragon Con. But, you know, fans, they were from England and from Australia. And they had brought stuff for us to sign. And it was just like, it was a pretty neat experience. And there are, through that experience, there are Cobra Kai fans that I have made friends with online.
Yeah.
And you know, we're in Facebook groups and follow each other on Twitter and all that stuff. But like people that I've been talking to for over a year, like meeting some of them face to face was like, that was really neat.
Oh, I can imagine.
So yes, Susan, I would love to do that.
Brilliant. And Cobra Kai Companion is a great show. It's to be fair to me. It's I have listened.
Oh, it's super fun.
Yeah. It's excellent. And I'll bring you on to my final question, Matt. Now, this is a signature question. And I had a chap called Mike Quinn on my show a few years back who has been a Muppeteer with Jim Henson for 35 years, must be now. And he's been to Star Wars and things like that. And someone sent this question to him. And I thought, you know what? That is such a brilliant personality question. I'm going to try and ask everybody I speak to. So, if you could have a Muppet created after your own character of your own personality, what Muppet would it be? And it could be a mix. It could be just one of what that's already made. It could be a mix of a couple, or it could be a brand new Muppet.
Wow. I don't know what this Muppet would look like, but I think personality-wise, I think I'm some sort of mixture. Like sometimes I'm Bert, sometimes I'm Ernie. I don't know if I'm ever wise or calm enough to be a Kermit. But I think I'm definitely, when I'm at my best, as kind as Big Bird. So a mixture of those guys.
That's one abomination of a mix. If you mix it,
I don't know what that would look like. I'm no puppeteer. I'm just the actor. Yeah. You know,
fair enough. Cool. Is that Bert? That's nice. I actually sang. It's not a very good one, but that's how I started my show. I did a Kermit the Frog impression, and I sang it. I did the little song to this chap, and he was like, "Okay." I was like, thanks. You've just I did, you know, the rainbow song, why they go, why are there so many songs about rain? That's my Kermit.
That's great.
You've heard my Yoda.
Do or do not.
Bad impressions. That's what got my stoke started. Cool. Anyway, Matt, is there anything you would like to say to people who are listening or watching as a final parting comment before I stop recording?
I think, just if you've made it this far, then bless your heart and thanks for listening. I know that as far as this quarantine thing that all of us are dealing with right now, and a lot of other things all of us are dealing with right now, especially here in the U.S., that it's really easy sometimes to get depressed or anxious or angry or, you know, sad, frustrated. And I think, I think the more that we keep in mind that all of those reactions are natural and that they're okay, and the more that we can cut each other slack as we get through this together, the better. But we're not going to be able to get through it, and it's not going to get over with until everybody starts wearing masks. And that's just a fundamental truth. So mask up and wash your hands. And if we all do that, then this virus dies away. But believe in the scientists and the doctors and, cross-referenced, researched scientific material. And, as opposed to like something you saw on YouTube that is not true. So everybody just hang in there and stay healthy and listen to the experts, and we'll all get through this together.